Welcome to episode 108 of Honestly Unbalanced, where we chat to more people that have tried to make your life a little bit better. Now, I love all of our guests so much, but occasionally I use the fact I have a podcast to chat to someone that I am so desperate to chat to in a very kind of selfish way. And this is one of those people. I've known Sean Tucker for quite a long time. Not well, but he photographed an event I was part of many years ago. And since then, I have been obsessed with him. If I go traveling and I want to watch some videos on a plane and save them on YouTube, it will be mainly his videos. Now, he is a photographer, but to call him a photographer isn't in any way doing him justice. I think of him as a philosopher, really, and just an inspiration for creativity. Let me tell you a little bit about him. So he's a photographer, filmmaker, author, and speaker based in the UK, and has told visual stories for individuals, NGOs, and big multinational corporations across more than 20 countries. He's traveled many long hours as a solo filmmaker and photographer, creating work with a meaningful message. And he's helped organizations set up in-house studios and train them to tell their own compelling visual stories. His YouTube is getting more and more popular as he's built it over the last few years, and he seeks to inspire other creatives. That doesn't necessarily just mean photography, by the way. And he's written and published a book sharing his philosophy, The Creative Life, called The Meaning in the Making. In this episode, we chat about the creative potential of your subconscious mind, why we need to get bored more often, finding your creative voice, deciding what success is to you and how to connect with your core audience, having courage to share your work and the challenges of receiving feedback, and also the struggles tied with turning your creative outlet into your only source of income. So whether you are a creative professionally, whether you are someone who likes to have a creative outlet on the side, or actually, to be honest, anyone that works in any industry has a need to be creative. And as a yoga teacher, I actually think Sean's lessons can apply to me a huge deal. So I want you to enjoy the episode, but before you do so, a few little deals for you. First, we've got a sale on our Dorset retreat. If you fancy joining Holly and I in Dorset for an amazing weekend full of ridiculously good food, ice bath, sauna, they're optional, sound healing, yoga, then you can get up to £250 off per person if you head to adamhustler.com/Dorset. You can also grab 10% off the best life form mats in the world with code HUSTLER10. You can get 10% off my favorite clothes by Colorful Standard with code ADAMHUSTLER, CS10, and 10% off Viva Barefoot Shoes with code ADAMHUSTLER, VB. And we also, side note, have a sale on our online studio, which is up to 30% off for the next week or two. And that's hundreds of classes with me, loads with Holly as well. And we've just actually bought an amazing new mic. I've spent so much money on mics, but this is the perfect mic for recording fitness movement style classes. I think that's enough for me now, isn't it? You guys enjoy the episode. Honestly
Unbalanced. Why do we get our best ideas in the shower?
Because I think it's the one time in our day that we don't have a screen in our face. You know, I mean, I think if we pay attention, I mean, you know, your phone has this little thing about telling you, you know, what your screen time is. That's just your phone. And you think about if you add it up in your day, computer screens, phone screens, tablets, TV, Netflix, whatever else, how much time you've actually, you're putting something in front of your face to take something in. I think it's the one time in your day where you are just alone, probably, and you're just enjoying the sensation of the shower, the water. And you, I mean, I always end up closing my eyes. I don't know about you, but you just want to feel that sensation of the water on you. And I think in that space, you click into a different psychological space. And I always talk to creatives a lot, obviously. Who say, well, I'm running out of inspiration. I don't really know where to get ideas from. I don't have ideas. And I, when you quiz them a little bit and ask, are you making space for ideas? It quickly becomes apparent, no, you're running a million miles an hour and you never don't have something in front of your face where you're taking something in. There's no quiet. And I think it's that, I mean, in the book, I call it empty, agendaless, generative mind space. It's that subconscious level, you know, because if you're in the conscious, you're kind of, you're pushing for ideas, you're pushing for things that you want, but, you know, nothing seems to be coming. I mean, we call it in English, we call it racking our brains, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you need an idea, you'll sit there and you'll rack your brain. But what we usually mean is we're desperately trying to push through the same conscious thought channels, trying to get something new to shake loose. And I mean, racking was a medieval torture device. Like, it's just like stretching. Like, say, it's not helpful and it's not pleasant, actually. But we all seem to do it for some reason. Whereas if you give up, and we often do, we'll go like, I can't get ideas, I don't know what to do. And instead we go on a walk. When you're 20 minutes into the walk and you're not really thinking about the problem, suddenly the idea is there. And you weren't trying to force it. I think it's because our subconscious minds are much more supple, creative, and interesting than our conscious mind is. So the trick is, how do you create more of those unconscious generative mental spaces in your day, those moments of quiet where you're there without agenda, you're not trying to get an idea. If you go on a walk to say, I'm only going because I need to get the idea, you'll be walking going, is the idea yet? Is it there yet? Is it there? You're not doing it. You're not taking yourself out of that conscious space. Mm. And I think the shower is the one place almost all of us in the day accidentally experience that. Mm-hmm. So the trick is, how do we more consciously build those spaces into our day? Day by day.
So where do ideas come from then? Because you're suggesting they don't come from your conscious part of your mind or your brain. I think it's Elizabeth Gilbert who wrote Eat, Pray, Love. She writes an amazing book. I actually can't remember the name of it, but she talks about how... Big Magic, that's it. It's incredible. And she talks about how ideas are sort of floating in the ether and they almost choose you, almost like... But I don't know, do they belong to you? Are they a part of you? Or are they sort of floating out there ready to be grabbed and fertilised?
I think it's a bit of all that, isn't it? And it's also in the combination of who I am as well, because I don't think somebody else is necessarily going to get the same set of ideas I'm going to get. Mm-hmm. And that's because I'm wired a particular way. You know, I have a particular personality type. So I'm an INFJ on the Myers-Briggs. So I'm more of an introvert. I'm quite intuitive. I sit more in the feeling space and I've got that judging end, which means I'm quite organized as well. So that's how, like on a very basic level, that's how I'm wired. And you could do a ton of different tests and find out. And I've also had like life experiences, mm-hmm. which have, you know, I grew up in Africa. I didn't really grow up here. So that shaped how I see the world as well. It means I don't, if I'd only just, and I was born in the UK, but I moved over to Africa when I was 2 years old and didn't come back until I was mid 30s. So what did that do to the way that I see the world? All those things, I think, come together in who we are, that when we step into that generative subconscious space, ideas will come to you that come out of who you actually are. So I think it's a combo. It's the ideas will find you, but we're also wired and predisposed to different sorts of ideas. And that means that when we make something, our flavor, our voice comes out because of the combination of all those things as well.
It sounds like the space that could generate these ideas is essentially the space of boredom, which is often something that people are actually scared of now. And I fear for, you know, we've got a child, another child on the way. I fear almost that he will never get to experience boredom. And it's, you know, it's such a powerful thing. So are there any other ways you try and find what could be called boredom beyond the shower? And because you say there that, you know, we shouldn't be actually trying to look for the ideas consciously. Mm. We should let them appear. And the only way to let them appear is to look for nothing, which in itself is an emptiness. So yeah, if you could speak to that slightly.
Yeah, it's the agendaless part is really important because it becomes a lifestyle pattern we build in rather than a trick we use when we need an idea. So one of the things I used to do was, you know, I've been working for myself now for 5-6 years. But when I was in London, you know, I mean, my worst commute in London was an hour and 45 minutes to work each way on three trains. So it was 6 trains a day, 3.5 hours. It's a nightmare. Mm. But then I suddenly realized when I'm working for myself, my commute is between my bedroom and this office is about 10 meters. You know what I mean? I could be in my PJs in seconds. So I thought, well, I've almost been gifted this time. So what should I do with it? So for a long time, I built in a commute every day. I didn't need one, but instead of that commuting time, I went for a walk around the common or whatever it was. And that became this little patch in my day where I was just going to go every day as a ritual, as a thing that I did. So that in that process, I gave myself that regular space without agenda for ideas to flow. And I often found that when I came back, first thing I'd do would be to go to a notebook. I didn't go for ideas, but I had one, and I had to go back and write them down, and then I could get on with my day. So there is that. But I think the boredom thing you raise is really important, because I reckon I would say maybe boredom is one thing we don't like, but I also think a lot of us are afraid of spending time with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because the minute there's quiet, things start to surface. It just happens naturally. That's what that subconscious mind does. It kicks up everything you're pushing down. And a lot of us are squashing things we're afraid to look in the face. And I think those of us especially who tend to be workaholics or very, very driven people, you know, we really put those people on a pedestal. Anyone who's driven, they're really what we should be like. We shouldn't have a second in the day. It's really trendy to say, oh, I'd love to have coffee with you this week, but I just don't have a spare second. You know, I'm so busy.
I don't have capacity. Capacity as well.
Yeah, exactly. But we all think about people like that. We go, oh, they're so busy. They must be so successful. You know what I mean? Mm. And I think it's a lot of people like that are using it as a cover for, I just can't be left alone with myself for a second because there's some dark things that come up that I need to face. And I think that a big part of making space a practice is getting comfortable with yourself, learning to like yourself, being okay with silence, being okay with space, not having to fill it. And stuff like that happens because we build self-awareness. You know, we get to know ourselves. We go to therapy and we work through our issues. We work out what are we suppressing the whole time. And the more we do that, the more comfortable space becomes. I think you're right. Boredom's definitely an element, but I think that's a big part of it too.
And I think you're right that people try and avoid being with themselves, like even in a yoga context. Meditation for many people is the hardest bit. Just lying down on the back for even a few minutes at the end of class is the hardest part.
People run away, don't they? They leave.
Some people actively leave. People that have done yoga for 10 years almost try and escape before that bit where they have to actually not be distracted by the handstand or not be distracted by the crazy pose, just to be with themselves. And I think all of us need to find space for that boredom. Well, maybe forget the phrase boredom. Let's just call it space with ourselves. I think all of us need to do something to discover that. And Neil Gaiman, who is one of my favorite writers, you know, he used to say that he would allow himself to go into his studio, his writing studio, and he was allowed to do two things. He was allowed to write or do nothing. And that was it. So two options. There was no phone, no device. It was just he could do one of those two things. And all of us should try and, I guess, do something like that, shouldn't we? But it's a guilt, I think, as well. It's not only the unwillingness to be with ourselves, but actually, I'm going to refer to something you wrote in the book on page 178. The fear, ultimately, envy, just like perfectionism and neediness, is fueled by some very real fears. Fear that I'm falling behind, fear that I'm not good enough, fear that I'm not as talented as others, fear that I'll not be able to achieve what others have, fear of failure, and maybe even a fear, and you go on with some more wonderful words. And I guess that's a big factor as well. Not just a not wanting to be with himself, but the fear that there is time that isn't utilized, that should be utilized to compete and succeed.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's so true. You know, it's because anyone who's ever written a book or created anything, honestly, like you know that it takes a lot of doing nothing to get to the good stuff. You have to make that space. I was talking to a friend of mine last week who's a painter. We talk every week. He's a good friend of mine from the States. And he was saying it's very hard to explain to people how I do just sometimes need a morning where I'm not outwardly productive. If you watch me, you go like he's doing nothing. But I have to have those to get to the idea where I can actually go and start to execute on it. And I mean, I found it right in the book as well. I gave my anyone who's written a book will know you've got to be a little bit disciplined about it if you want it to get finished on time. And so I said to myself, I'm going to give myself 1 hour a day where I have to sit down at the computer, no other tabs open, nothing else on, nothing else happening, and I have to sit there for an hour. And if I don't do anything, it's fine, but it has to be at least an hour. And I'd often find myself, you know, writing for 3 hours then. But some days it would be just sitting and staring at a screen for an hour or jotting down things on a notebook. That might be an idea, that might be not. That I crossed all of them out the next day. You have to also go through all those to get to the good stuff, I think.
And another layer to kind of giving yourself the space, and you talked about how, you know, things come up to the surface that you need to address, you know, in that space. And you also talk in your book about how really to express your art in its most authentic form, you need to know yourself and you need to go on that journey of doing the self-work in order for your art to be the best it can be. So can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're all obsessed about what does my creative voice sound like? I mean, you know, obviously I work a lot with photographers and they're all obsessed with, you know, what camera should I use? What lens should I use? What colors am I going to favor in my images? What's my subject matter going to be? What am I going to say of my images? But I think a lot of them make the mistake, and this happens in every creative endeavor, where they're not honest about their motivation. And their motivation is, I want some money and I want people to like me in masses. And so what they do is they look at what's out there already and they go, okay, well, let me see what's popular. And then let me try and just reverse engineer that a little bit and just do a version of it. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you completely kill your opportunity at having your own creative voice, because you're just producing a weak copy of what you think other people like out there. You have to get that all in context and then start to look into yourself and say, beyond that, whether or not it's popular, let me start with this. Let me start with, you know, who am I? What do I care about? What do I want to say because I think it matters? And how can I do that as simply and as powerfully as I can possibly do with the skills I have, with the particular way I see the world and all those kind of things? It's a braver route to go. I mean, I think on the one hand, you could cynically say people just do that because they just want fame and popularity. Yeah. And maybe that's true as well. But on the other side, I think there's a vulnerability that comes with making work that is as much like you as you can make it. Because then you feel like if you give it away to the world and they don't like it, they don't like you. And that's a lot more personal than they just don't like a set of images that I took. So there's the two sides. I do want people to love this in numbers, but also I'm afraid of giving stuff out that really feels like me because it feels super personal and vulnerable.
Do you think it's important for people to go on that journey? Can you skip to the end and just know yourself and be original and put yourself out there? Or do you think that you have to start from scratch, imitating someone else, go on this journey of, you know, the challenges getting to know yourself before you can, is it a process? And have you been on it as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think some people are amazing. They just seem to be able to, you know, pick up a camera or whatever they're doing, start writing a book or write a piece of music. And it just is them from day one. They're just these phenoms. That does happen, but not for most of us, and certainly not for me. I think it is a big process. And imitation is a part of that. You know, I think, I mean, I can clearly see who my influences in photography or filmmaking or anything have been. And that was conscious. I was trying to be honest with myself along the way, going, I don't just want to copy the popular, although I definitely failed on that a number of times as well. And in my head, I'm going, oh, maybe they'll love this because it looks like so-and-so's. But it was more, I think what you do when you do that, if you're imitating a stable of heroes rather than just like one person you're trying to rip, what you're doing is you're saying, this is the work that really resonates with me for some reason. And let me try what they're doing, especially as a beginner. It's the only way you learn is by imitating other people. But as you go, you'll get close to that and you realize, nah, but this element of their work is not for me and that's not, but I love what they're doing now. And over time, you'll start to build this very varied set of influences that is hopefully authentic to you because it's the things that you resonate as a human being or a personality in all that work together. Mm-hmm. And you start to build your own thing. But it's a super messy process and it's okay that it is. I think it is for most of us and it should be. But hopefully as you go, that your voice starts to emerge out of all that imitation and all that experimentation.
I love that.
There's a writer called Austin Kleon who wrote a book, Steal Like an Artist.
Yep.
Which is kind of the wonderful, like long version of bit of the conversation we've just had. Yeah. I think as well, you often see people trying to imitate people who are way further down in their career as well. Yep. It's like someone who's just starting some TV presenting and they try and look at Oprah and replicate what Oprah's doing. Yeah. You know, they look at people who are 20 years down, who are super successful and try and imitate that. And of course, not only then do they not find success because they're not as good as Oprah, no, Oprah's at a different stage, but they have the added problem, as you say, of not ever finding finding who they are. Like, what were your in? What did you have any influences outside of photography for your photography?
Outside of photography, the biggest influences have been cinematography. So films have been really important for me. So cinematographers like Roger Deakins or Emmanuel Lubezki or Wally Pfister, they were people who shot in a way that felt like they gave me the feeling that I wanted my images to give to other people. And it's not even that it, because it's not actually that easy to pull cinematography into an image. I mean, I walk around on the street for a lot of my photographs. You know, when you're on a film set, you've got, you know, lighting departments and the best cameras in the world, amazing actors, interesting characterful faces, set designers, props, costume designers. I mean, the world is put together for you. And I'm walking around the street going, I hope I see something half interesting today. It's completely different. You can't actually copy one for one what they're doing, but you can be taking little influences, like the way that cinema uses quite hard light and shadow is something I used to be afraid of as a photographer until I saw how they use it in cinema and went, oh, actually, there's interesting ways to use this that mask some of the image and create a bit of mystery so you don't know the whole story. And that makes you question more than just something obvious. And I think things like that have definitely influenced. Books have influenced, paintings have influenced hugely. Like my portrait style used to be very, very complicated. It used to be, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 lights sometimes on the subject. And I used to go and sit in room 22 in the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square where the Rembrandts are. Mm. And it was looking at Rembrandt's work that I realized these portraits aren't great because he got fancy with the lighting because he couldn't, because it's just one light coming in through the window. He didn't have multiple lights. He had one light coming in through a window. And I thought, well, if that is so powerful, why am I trying to get so complicated with it? And I started to reverse engineer back. And now 95% of the portraits I take is just one light because I think that's what works best. So that completely changed my way of thinking about photography as well. So lots of things I've pulled from other places.
More than most people I know in that world, kind of most people kind of in general, you can look at anything like art and most people don't seem to see their job as art and will, for no blame of their own, do the thing that seems most commercially viable. Yep. Of course, because we need money, we need to house our children, etc. And I guess the question for all of us is, would we rather have moderate success in life, whatever you want to call it, moderate success, but have stayed true to ourselves, or immense financial success and like objective external validation success, and actually have lost ourselves along the journey? And I know you turned down the offer from a publisher for a book which was like a how-to photography style book, which I'm sure would have made a fair bit of money. Equally, I'm sure it probably would have ended up like in the works or like after 5 years, you know, the cycle of books go. But could you speak to that a little bit? Like what drives you and how have you navigated that? People offering you money, as you know, as someone now who has a big YouTube following and a big social media following and a reputation, I'm sure you're still getting, well, and probably an increasing amount of offers, which is just pure money for slightly selling your soul. And yeah, so how do you navigate success? And then on a broader question, what does success mean for you at this point in your life?
I mean, I want to be careful because I know that there are people who are doing things that I wouldn't do and they're not wrong for doing it. You know, everyone has to find their own line with it and work out what they're happy to do. So everything I say from this point on is just for me. It's not for anybody else. It's not how you should do it. But when I started out, I always had a very clear reason of why I was doing any of this. I genuinely wanted to help. And I didn't, it's no secret. Anyone who watches my YouTube channel will know it's about photography, but it's not about photography. It's a bit of a Trojan horse to talk about other things about, and specifically the dent I want to make in the world is I think that in our modern society, we have a pandemic of anxiety and depression and people being more unsure of themselves than ever, it feels like. And that's the difference I want to make. And I knew that from the start. There is no magic f-stop you're going to use on your lens that's going to make you take amazing photographs. And I'm not the one to teach you that. I don't care. That's not what's interesting to me. So because I had a really clear idea at the start what I wanted to talk about and a clear idea of what I thought success was going to be for me, and that it, to define it really simply, it was, if I can just make enough money that I can keep making the work that I love making, I'm happy. I'm not a very financially ambitious person. I'm not trying to get, you know, big houses and cars. I couldn't care about that stuff. If I can pay the bills and keep making the work that I want to make for the rest of my days in a moderate way, I'm maxed out. I'm happy. I don't need anything else than that. And there was a guy named Kevin Kelly who put out a pretty popular blog post years ago called 1,000 True Fans. Mm-hmm. And his whole thing was, you only need, as an artist of any sort, you only need 1,000 true fans to make a living. And it was never meant to be taken super literally, but the idea was, if you can have 1,000 true fans, and a true fan is somebody who will buy a print from you, come to a talk you do, go to a workshop or a retreat or something, they'll engage with you on that level, you can probably turn that into a living, just 1,000 true fans. So I've never taken big subscriber numbers seriously or big following numbers, because most of those people, to be very frank with you, I mean, you go to my channel now and you see, well, there's over 500,000 subscribers there. That's true and that's nice, but then go check how many people are still watching the videos. Mm. And it is 5 to 10% of that massive number.
Oh, really?
Which means that, and it's true for a lot of YouTube channels, it's not just me. Like, what that means is, though, someone once found a video I did, and it's probably something like how to shoot a portrait with a single speed light. Because people use YouTube like a search engine. They need a quick answer to a question, and I gave them that answer in a tutorial, and I'm happy to give those tutorials. But then they realize, what, the next video he's sitting waffling on his couch for 15 minutes. I don't want to listen to that, and they're gone. And that's okay. Like, I'm fine with that, because I know what's important to me. I know how the world works. I know most people are just going to use me for those quick tips and tricks, and when I'm not doing that, they couldn't care less, and I'm fine with that. But there's a core audience at the middle, which is a much smaller number. Those are the guys I really care about. Those are the people that I really want to keep connected with, because they care about the same stuff I do. And I feel like we can help each other doing that sort of work. Mm-hmm. And there's 1,000 decisions I have to make about that every time I put something out. I mean, I know how to play the game. If I want a bigger channel, I just need to start doing gear reviews on cameras, because mm-hmm. people want to know which camera to buy, or give them quick tips and tricks for beginners, because most of the people on YouTube are beginners watching photography tutorials. I know how to do it, but I wouldn't like the work that I made. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to me. I want to go to bed at night feeling proud of what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And if I can pay the mortgage off and keep, you know, roof over my head and food on the table doing that, I don't need more than that. I'm happy with that.
It sort of ties in. Can we talk a little bit about perfectionism? Because you say in your book that someone once said to you that they wish that they were a perfectionist, and you said back to them that actually you wouldn't wish it upon your worst enemy. You know, it's crippling, and it's put so many obstacles in the way. So you would describe yourself as a perfectionist. How do you navigate it when putting your work out?
First of all, it's acknowledging what it is, I think. And, you know, because when this person said this to me, I think they thought that a perfectionist is someone who everything they do is perfect.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. It's not what a perfectionist is. Perfectionism is fear, really. And it's fear that I can't control the work that I put out, and I can't control the responses to it. I can't guarantee that everyone who sees this thing I made will love it, because none of us can ever do that, right? Everything we put out into the world is going to be met with a soup of responses. Some people will love it, some will hate it, and some won't even care about it, which may even be worse. And because that's the reality, I think a perfectionist is often somebody who goes, well, if I can't guarantee that if I put this photograph online that I'm going to get this many likes and loads of positive comments, then I'm too afraid to do it. I'm keeping it back. And we make excuses like, oh, it's just not ready, or, you know, I'm still working on this project. But we also know that we use excuses like that, and those projects will often never see the light of day, because we're too afraid to find the courage to give that stuff away to the world, knowing some people won't like it. And I think at the root of it, that's what perfectionism really is. And I suppose how I deal with it, for me, it's just a choice. It has to come down to a choice. I have to feel the fear and do it anyway. Mm. You know, I have to say, I am afraid that people won't like it, but I'm still choosing to give it away. I read a book recently. It was very popular. I'm sure you've heard of it. The title is called The Courage to Be Disliked. Mm. And it's written, it's two Japanese authors who are writing from a philosopher to a student, and this conversation going backwards and forwards, and how the student will not find happiness in their life until they find the courage to be disliked, to make decisions for things they believe in and want to do, even if their friends think they're stupid for doing it or their parents disagree with them doing it because they don't think it's a good idea. The courage to be disliked is where you start making interesting work and finding the courage to go, you might not like this, you might not even get it, but here it is. I stand by this. I think this is important or interesting or good or worth your time.
Do you think that's like, sorry, do you think that's like a muscle? Do you think, because I would say I'm probably more on the people pleasing side. Is it something that you overcome by just doing it and then you just build more resilience and you just keep doing it? Is it like a muscle, would you say?
Yes, I think it is. I think the more you do it and the more you receive, because you will receive the negative stuff. That's the fact is people won't like what you do and some won't like you. I mean, I've had some horrendous trolls come around on all my accounts many times. I've got people who are regulars who
keep, regular you know trolls. I mean?
Yeah, but what I've also done is as I've continued to choose to share things with the world, and you take in the positive and the negative, there's a couple of things that happen. The one is you start to realize where the negative stuff is coming from. And putting it into context, right? Because as human beings, we have this problem where we overemphasize anything negative that comes back and we underplay the positive feedback we get on anything, right? But when you realize where the negative stuff's coming from, that, and I realized this one day by making a mistake, by because I used to push back a lot. If someone came around and was rude on my Instagram because of some image I posted, I'd be a little bit of a bully and be like, and I'd have a go back at them and going, Well, let's see your work, sunshine, kind of thing. You know? And it was like, which was always rubbish, of course. And it's like, because you don't get talented trolls. They're always frustrated creatives who can't make their work yet. They're not quite there yet. So they need to poke at something else because they're angry. Mm. But then I sat down and I thought, who did I just send that message to? Because I don't know, right? It might have been a 14-year-old living at home with abusive parents.
Yeah.
That's what I might have just done.
It could be one of your family members.
It could never be, exactly, more than likely. You just don't know, right? And so when you don't know where that negativity and that anger is coming from, there's no point in taking it seriously, right? And there's no point in taking the positive seriously either. You have to be fair on both sides. Just because people blow smoke up your ass because you did something, you don't know where that's coming from either. Do they know what they're talking about? Maybe they don't. In which case, you've got to start to just sift it all and go like, how much of this is important? What's important where? And then the positive negative thing I think is really important. There's a psychologist named Rick Hansen, I think his name was, and he talked about the Velcro Teflon principle. And he says that because human beings are wired in such a way that we're evolutionarily trained to spot danger and difficulty, right? We know how to do that. In fact, we will leave all celebration for a much later date because we're looking for what might go wrong right now. The lion stalking us through the grass is much more important than the fact that we're going to get back to the village and have a party tonight, right? It's this, we've got what he calls a negativity bias. And he says that this Velcro Teflon thing, he says, when negative thoughts attach to us or negative feedback attaches to us, it's like Velcro, it snaps on straight away. But positive stuff just slides off us like Teflon. And so what you have to do is you have to hold the positive thought or the positive feedback in your head consciously for 20 seconds to give it the same chance to imprint as a negative thought automatically has, right? So that's the other thing, is when we put stuff out into the world, I think the fear that perfectionists have about the negativity coming is because we focus and obsess and let it all attach like Velcro whilst all the positive is sliding off. But when you get deliberate about balancing that out, you start to realize like, what I made is mostly good and that's enough. Right. Instead of it has to be brilliant and I'm only looking at the negative.
I love that.
And I just, it made me think though, at the same time, there is a community now of people, I guess, or a social movement of holding on to the positivity for a little bit too long.
What do you mean?
As in it just fuels their ego. So they only listen to the positive and then told, oh my goodness, you're the best photographer ever. And they really hold that tight. And they believe.
And absolutely. Yeah,
I often say to my, I kind of mentor teachers, and I would often say to them, generally speaking, ignore all feedback to some degree. Like, obviously don't ignore it. If class numbers are going down consistently for 2 years, that's good feedback to listen to. If your teacher comes to a class, listen to their feedback. You respect them and where their ideas come from. But if it's someone who randomly comes along and is having a good day and says, oh my God, that was the best class ever. You don't know where that, even though you're face to face, you don't know where that came from. Maybe they just have a really nice coffee. Maybe they had some cannabis before class. Who knows? They've had a really wonderful day, or they liked your voice or liked your leggings, but equally the negativity as well. And I said, unless that person, you respect everything they do and everything they would say, and you would read their books and go to their class, then to some degree, ignore it. Never look at reviews on the internet. And my policy online is always, if someone writes something negative, delete their account, block them and delete them and get rid of it. But equally, the positive, I try and avoid indulging that too much as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the book, I talk about where you should take feedback from. And I think it should be a very, very small group. And it should pass two tests. One is that you should really know what they're talking about. And they should really care about you, because otherwise, what's the point? Yeah. They have to know my subject matter as well as I do, hopefully more, and they have to care about my onward journey. So someone leaving some trolley comment probably doesn't know what they're talking about, and they definitely don't care about me. But equally, someone leaving a positive comment, they might care about my journey or feel like they do, but they don't really know me, and they probably don't know what they're talking about either. So I have, I don't know, like 8 people who I would take seriously if they said to me, that last thing you did, I'm not sure that's you, I'm not sure it's good, I'm not sure whatever, that them I'll listen to. But everything else, positive or negative, gets put through that like filter of maybe this isn't helpful.
I guess you want to be sure that they would also be truthful as well. I actually read an article the other day, which was about, it wasn't just about this, but it mentioned, like, if your partner says, do I look good in this dress? Yeah. Should you tell them the truth or not?
Yeah.
And the guy was like, actually, you should. Because then when you're still together, hopefully when you're 80, and you say, actually, I do still find you beautiful, they'll believe you. But if all you've ever said is you look lovely in that dress, then your words mean nothing.
I would go further. I would say a friend who doesn't tell you, or a partner who doesn't tell you when you're making a mistake, might not love you enough. Because I feel like they're more concerned with, I'm going to say this negative thing to you and you might not like me. It's self-protection. Instead of going, I'm going to tell you something where I think you might be making a mistake and risk that you might not like me or might be angry with me because I really care about you and your journey. And it doesn't mean they have to listen to me. Like, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm going to say it as kindly as I can. And I'm going to be as honest as I can because I really care about you. Like, my friends who are in my life, I've got that group, and we are like brutally honest with each other. But I have a group of friends who they can say absolutely anything to me because I know where it's coming from and I'm convinced they care. And it's the only reason to say it, even if they're having a bad day. They're not taking it out on me. They genuinely care. And I think that's what we should aim for.
I find men, at least a lot of my friends, are quite nasty to each other and quite cruel to each other and quite brutal. And it's acknowledging that we're really nasty to each other, but don't actually mean it, which I'd much prefer than being nice to each other and not actually mean it. But there is always as well, although they're quite cruel, there is, you know, we know they're kidding, but there's always that half-truth, which I think is important. So the delivery can be different. So I think friends that love you, the delivery might be through cruelty, but there is always that half-truth there compared to, let's say, a peer in the same sector as you, which might present it in a more constructive way.
Exactly. I mean, you've got to have those moments with people you love where you go, I'm going to say something serious now. I'm not joking around. Like, I mean what I'm about to say to you, and I'm only saying it because I care. And then you give them something hard. Like, those are powerful moments in any relationship. Those are like, do you remember that day in the park 5 years ago where you said to me, that really stuck with me. Like, we have to grow up and be able to do that. We can't always just be joking or just saying nice stuff to each other. We have to have those, like, I care too much not to say this. Here it comes, you know.
Changing direction a little bit, I'm just looking at your beautiful front cover of your book, The Meaning in the Making, and your tagline is the why and how behind our human need to create. So I'm just wondering, I mean, are all humans creative? I don't really know what the question is, but I just want to talk about humans being, because I guess, you know, there's a lot of people that have, you know, normal 9-to-5 jobs and they don't really have the time or the energy to be creative and nurture that side of them. I don't know. Is there anything you want to say about that?
I mean, I would say I would say every human being is creative. And I think, I mean, the way I talk about it in the book is I talk about the first chapter, I talk a little bit about order and chaos. Mm. And I talk about how we rely on order. You know, we rely on things like gravity to stop us just spinning off into the universe. The fact that everything just sort of seems to work. And, you know, religious people have ideas about why they think that is the way that it is. And scientists have some ideas about why they think that that is the way that it is. And you know, I mean, I used to be a pastor in the church. I've left a long time ago, and I don't really hold those ideas as specifically now. But I think it's interesting that human beings are always trying to understand why just stuff just seems to keep working the way that it does. Mm-hmm. And but we're also terrified of the chaos, right? And that's why we would, you know, sacrifice animals, because we had to please the gods to get rains coming so we could have crops so our family didn't starve. We have these crazy ideas through history about things we think we have to do to keep chaos at bay because it's going to come back at us. And so we've always got this like order chaos thing in our heads. And I think when we try and talk to each other about life and about how sometimes things work out and sometimes it just feels like broiling chaos, we don't often have language, especially those of us who aren't necessarily religiously inclined or scientifically minded. And I think then we go to creativity and we go to like, I'm gonna write a song or write a poem or paint a picture or take a photograph. Because in the act of doing that, we are creating a tiny bit of order out of the chaos. Like when I compose a photograph and I place things in the frame in the places I think they should be so that it feels pleasing to me, I've looked at a chaotic scene and I've made order out of it in that frame. When I use complementary colors on a canvas, when I paint something, those colors work together for me. I don't know why, I just feel that. We're creating a bit of order out of the chaos of a color palette that's in front of us with endless choices. I think, and whenever I talk about this, I always get some people going, yeah, but a lot of art is chaos. And I agree. Because then what we're doing is, even in describing chaos, we're creating order out of it. Because we're creating a sense of safety in numbers when we share that stuff with each other and we go, yeah, me too. I often have that feeling of like, I'm just out of control. Things aren't working, or the world's a painful place, or whatever it is. We're still creating that order out of chaos a little bit. Mm. So I suppose, and so many things can be creativity. You know, I think maths can be creative. Mm. You know, any mathematician, proper mathematician, it's creative problem solving. It's creating order out of chaos. I think that broad definition of, we're either trying to create some order out of the chaos or describe the chaos we're experiencing so we get that sense of safety in numbers with each other. And that sense of like, we're all in this together. I think art at its best, that's what it does. And because it's that broad, I reckon everyone on some level is.
But I do wonder, because I think, yes, everything could be said to be creative. You know, I talk about creative sequencing in yoga. But do you think it is worth everyone trying to cultivate a creative outlet where people have the chance to be creative just for creativity's sake? Because we could argue, I know, lots of people argue that everything is yoga, which I'm not necessarily a fan of. But I feel that without some creativity, I get sucked into a kind of monotony of life. Even though my life is comparatively, and you know, if you look externally, very interesting, I really get sucked into that. So I have, and although part of my work is creating reels and the like, I still don't think that is creative particularly, because it is very much tied up with work. And yes and no. So some of it is very much tied up with work and intention and what is the agenda behind this. Mm. Ultimately, when I create content, it's to get people to come to my class, come to my workshops. It's to educate or entertain with the ulterior motive of getting them to interact with me on a paid for level to some degree in the yoga sector. But I'm so happy that I have my camera and I have a separate like photography account that isn't really designed to do anything except me just express it and occasionally take some photos of yogis and the like. But I'm so happy that I have that outlet. And for years, I didn't have any kind of creative outlet. My outlet was exercise, which has certain benefits. But I just wonder to what degree it affects people who don't have that very tangible creative outlet that is there for the sake of creativity.
Yeah, I mean, it's essential. I don't know. It's very difficult to think how other people think about it. But I've always had something. You know, if I was a kid, I was drawing pictures. I was obsessed with drawing pictures. And then it was a bit of photography, and then it was playing in bands in my 20s, and then it was public speaking with the church stuff, and then it was photography and filmmaking and writing. I'm always jumping, and there's probably new things coming. You know, I've just picked up line and wash, which is like watercolors and ink stuff, which I'm terrible at, but I have to do it because it makes me happy. You know, it's just like something to set my mind at ease while I'm doing something very intuitive and very tangible. It puts me in a particular space emotionally and mentally. And I suppose the question is, what would that be for you? And even if we do it as part of our job, a lot of my creativity is my job now, but it's no less creativity for me. And I don't get to take less joy out of it just because it helps me pay the bills. I still love doing it all because it's expression. It's me saying, hey, this human being over here thinks this is important. What do you guys think? Do you know what I mean? There's something validating about that when you get it right. You know, there's something a little bit healing about that.
I love that.
I love what you said there about the thing you're doing that you're not particularly good at. Because I think in the modern world, there is pressure. Like if you start running, when are you running a marathon? If you start just drawing, or like when you're submitting it to a gallery, or I don't know, when you're doing an exhibition, there is a need to succeed through it.
Yeah. Well, that's often where your creativity gets poisoned, doesn't it? Because it becomes competitive and about beating the crowd out there or becoming popular with it. I know so many photographers, myself included at a point, who almost fell out of love with photography because it only became a job, because it became competition and money, and you lost the creativity. That's where I picked up street photography, because I was a product photographer shooting very, very dry, you know, like sofas and dining sets and stuff in a studio. And it was so technical, repetitive and dull that I started to get off the train one station early when I was on my way home in London. And I would just take that extra half hour to walk home and just photograph on my phone whatever I saw, to try go back to it just being fun and creative again. Like, you've got to protect it. When it starts to become money, popularity, competition, you've got to work hard to keep it for yourself. And maybe the way to do that is to always be having somewhere you're starting from scratch that's just for you and just playing again. That's important.
Should we do some little quick fires now? Unless you have a bigger, question?
No, I don't. No, go ahead if you have a quick fire.
Well, just so, random shorter questions. Do you print out any of your own artwork for your home?
Yeah, I do, yeah. So it's, all around the house. I've actually got a set of... we did an exhibition down in London a few years ago before what it would have been, beginning of 2020, just before the pandemic kicked off. And we had 45 black gallery frames around a gallery. And after we'd finished that, I bought all those frames off the organizer. So now I have those around my house, and I have my friend's work in there and my work in there, and it just constantly gets printed, rotated. And then obviously I do these magazines now, which are kind of writing and printing images around the theme, which I put out 2 a year. And that's, yeah, there's something about having a printed image, I think, that's that kind of special end point of a piece of work.
Anything, any last words that you'd like to share with the listeners? Any last words of wisdom or anything that's on in your heart?
the thing I hear most often when I do talks around is people sort of, it's a lot of beginners battling because the road ahead looks very, very long to get anywhere meaningful, like for their work to get very good, or for them to get any kind of positive feedback from a meaningful audience. I always just end up saying that it's just one step at a time. And it sounds simple, but I mean, it's something I literally tell myself now. If the next thing feels daunting, I'll say to myself in my head, just do the next little thing and you'll eventually get there. And it's proved right time and again. Don't put all that massive goal in your head all at once and put all the pressure on yourself to get there as fast as possible, because you won't enjoy the journey. You won't enjoy the process of growing and getting there. So just do the next little thing, and then wake up the next day and do the next little thing, and just do that 1,000 times and see where you wind up.
Great advice. Thank you so much.
And where can people find you? Obviously, your book, Meaning in the Making, is available everywhere you can get books. And where else?
If you punch in Sean Tucker, SEANTUCKER on YouTube, you'll find me there. And SEANTUCK, Sean Tucker on Instagram. And there's links.
Is that because someone had Tucker? So Sean Tucker already. It's hard to navigate that, isn't it? Someone had Holly Hustler already, which I presume
that's so
was like
rude.
a but the account wasn't available, so I think a porn star might have had Holly Hustler.
It is a porn star name.
And then and then got it blocked because it was unavailable.
So selfish.
That's hilarious. Very rude.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Love you guys. Thank you.